Hello, and welcome to another episode of the ZA Tech Show. I'm Brett Haggard. Thanks for joining us. What started out as being two guests in the studio today has ended up being myself and just one guest in the studio today. That guest is a man who parked his camel at the door of the ZA Tech Show studios on his way out of his cave, otherwise known as the Mail and Guardian and Ungeeked and a variety of other places inside his cave, Mr. Benedict Kelly. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Brett.
How's it going, man?
Yeah, not too bad.
Good, good, good.
So is this the cycling show today?
Oh, yes, indeed. The two cyclists. And we'll try not to speak too much about cycling now that we've managed to get rid of Duncan McLeod. Oh, wait, did I just say that? Duncan and ourselves have both experienced a complete server outage. So HTXT and Tech Central is currently down. It'll be up by the time you hear this podcast. But I've assigned Adam to sorting that out for us. And Duncan, of course, needed to run out to figure out what's gone on with his server. But yeah, there you go. Cat's out of the bag. We had Duncan McLeod hanging out with us, and then he needed to run off. It's okay. Ben Kelly and I have done this so many times before. We'll just soldier on. Ain't that right, Mr. Kelly?
Always.
So let's jump straight into it. I spent a week last week in Barcelona playing with a variety of gadgets and other cool stuff at a small technology conference known as Mobile World Congress.
Just a few friends getting together.
Absolutely, over a couple of beers and cell phones. We were just talking before the show about how it's become relatively simple to keep up with what's going on in the industry during these kinds of events as a result of all of the live streams. Now, did you manage to hook into any of the live streams from South Africa while Mobile World was going on?
I was watching some of the live blogs, and but not necessarily streaming it directly.
Sure.
You know, sometimes it takes a little bit too much time, and the blog, you can just walk away and not miss anything because you can just scroll back down and
reread the
synopsis of what's been going on for the last 10 minutes. I did that with the Apple announcement as well. I just scrolled down. I'd missed the whole thing, and I just scrolled down to the bottom of one of the live blogs and then quickly flicked through it, and I get a very good idea of what's going on.
That was relatively actually quite a lackluster one, but we'll get into that afterwards. Let's speak about Mobile World first. So, I mean, obviously I was there, at a couple of the events and stuff like that. And the one thing I noticed was that, you know, the industry seems to be struggling for inspiration at the moment. There's great technology inside of all of the devices I got a chance to play with, but it just, from a look and feel perspective, some vendors have gotten so much better at producing stuff, and others are really, really struggling. I write a column every single month for Slow Magazine, and that's actually something that I wrote for the upcoming issue, is how impressed, ironically enough, I was with Samsung and its release of the Galaxy S6 and S6 Edge, specifically the Edge, because I felt like the last two versions of the Galaxy S devices were actually quite lackluster and very blah, whereas the S6 is more interesting, and the S6 Edge for me is just absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, everything's largely a kind of an incremental change over the law. So, I mean, you can kind of draw a line in the sand around sort of so with the iPhones, probably the latest generation. Before that, the fives, or even the 4S's were pretty damn good. And then with the Samsung devices, when they kind of settled on what the screen size was going to be for the Galaxy S's, and now with the Edge, I think it's a key differentiator for them. I mean, I've never been a big fan of Samsung's products. I felt they're like plasticky and too filled with bloatware for me to really care too much about them, really want one. I think they've seemingly resolved a lot of those issues. The new ones look great. The edges look fantastic.
Absolutely.
The screens look brilliant. And from all reports, they've cleaned out a lot of the junk which was cluttering up the, up the phones as well. So hopefully we've got a phone which is, because if you're buying a premium product, if you want to pay that kind of money, then you want a premium product.
Sure, absolutely.
And the reason the S5 didn't sell very well was because it didn't feel like a premium product. Samsung needed to escalate their game. They should have done it last year. They didn't, and they have done it this year, and I think they're going to see the results. I mean, we saw the results of them producing a substandard product last year.
Yes.
In their financial results, and I think you'll see exactly the opposite this year with the S6. Is that the results of them producing a premium product is going to pay off for them.
So yeah, and I mean, it is exactly that. It is a fantastic product. I was one of the lucky few to get my hands on the device. And get a chance to play with it. The camera is absolutely astounding. You're right about the screen. The screen is just, it belies belief. It really is absolutely gorgeous. I mean, the best description I can actually give it, we thought like we were playing with a dummy phone at one stage, because you know how crazy crisp those dummy phones inside the stores are when they've got that sticker stuck over them to simulate what the screen should look like. That is literally how crisp and really, really bright these screens are. The Edge screen itself, I think, in terms of functionality, still relatively gimmicky. For me, I don't know whether the actual functionality of being able to swipe in from the side or being able to do stuff like have a stock ticker or a Twitter ticker or something like that, or maybe a date and time ticking along the side, is all that revolutionary or groundbreaking. It just looks so damn cool. It feels so good in hand. It screams quality, and that's where I think they're going to get the ground back. Yeah. The S6, by contrast, for me, is a very standard looking phone. It's got a really, really nice kind of sturdy feel to it and that kind of thing. But I think that the Edge completely steals the show.
I think it's an issue of that you have to stand out from the crowd. With the HTC M8. Sorry, the M9. M9.
It looks so close to the M8. I can't tell the two apart, really.
The high-end Lumia devices, the iPhones, they all kind of blur. I mean, they all have their own distinctive points of view. They don't blur into each other, but they all feel like premium products. And the S6 is exactly the same in that ballpark. The Edge stands out from the crowd.
Absolutely.
Okay, the Lumia stand up in the crowd because they're
on Windows Phone and they've got these plasticky covers.
And they're in purple and pink and orange,
Sure.
So you can't not but notice them.
I don't mean plastically in a derogatory way. No, I mean, they have this fantastic, very sturdy resin kind of casing.
But it's a very distinctive look.
That's distinctive, exactly.
Yeah, it's a very distinctive look. So they stand out from the crowd that way. And the S6 doesn't necessarily stand out from the crowd. But the Edge does. And even if people don't use those two little pieces of screen which curve round for whatever purpose, the fact that they're there, the fact that they make a statement is what people care about. They don't necessarily need that extra screen real estate. But the fact that now you have the screen which essentially is completely borderless and goes across the Edge really makes a big difference, I think.
And I mean, it does really feel beautiful in hand. It's very sturdy. It's light, but yet it feels really, really robust. Overall, a really beautiful device. The intriguing bit for me that I don't know quite what it means yet, but I think it's an interesting just kind of side note, is the fact that both of the processors inside the S6 and the S6 Edge are the Samsung Exynos octa-core processor. They're not the Qualcomm processor anymore.
Okay.
And that, I think, is quite interesting because that is clearly quite a differentiator. They're reckoning it's a much faster processor. It's 64, but it does a whole bunch of different things. Of course, it's got these four low-power cores and these four high-power cores, which you can switch between very, very, with system switches between based on what it needs to do at any point in time. And, of course, now it's fully LTE capable. So it'll be quite interesting to see how that affects the overall reception that the devices actually get once we've had a chance to really bench them and take a look at them. But by all accounts, people are really, really impressed. I was very impressed when I played with it, so yeah. Another interesting device that was launched at Mobile World, and ironically enough, we actually got a sneak peek of the week before Mobile World, was the LG G Flex 2. Also, astoundingly good device, very, very interesting curved design, which feels really, really good in hand. A lot of those LG-isms are starting to really catch on right now in terms of the back on off button, which is located right under the camera lens, which actually takes a little bit of getting used to, but once you've kind of caught the hang of it, it's great to use that device. Also, astoundingly good screen, very solid processor, et cetera, et cetera. They focused a lot more on a number of the the camera features. So you've got the ability to do this gestural stuff. You can set the camera, you know, set it up and then do like a hand signal and it'll take the photo, which is quite interesting. You know, a couple
that's
of interesting features
there. That's where you always have somebody
there.
Doing bunny ears in your photograph.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. Hopefully they do the bunny ears and then put their hand away afterwards. But again, very, very nice device. You mentioned the HTC M9, which is also a really, really interesting device. I didn't get a chance to actually get a look at it, but by all accounts, really, really impressive device, except for, of course, the fact that a couple of people are disillusioned with the camera. HTC, of course, also now doing VR. They've got their own VR solution, which I think will be interesting.
That's in conjunction with Valve, though.
Exactly. Yeah. A device that I found very, very interesting is the Huawei TalkBand B2. There's a bunch of different devices and peripherals. Of course, there was the watch that Huawei launched also. But the TalkBand is quite interesting in that it everybody's trying to design like Fitbit-type wearables at the moment. And this has got a 6-axis accelerometer in, so it is properly like a fitness tracker. But what's quite interesting is you have the ability to snap the module out and stick it in your ear because it's also a Bluetooth headset, which I think is just unbelievably clever little tweak to that. And then other interesting features is the fact that Huawei has designed this entire fitness platform with APIs and stuff like that. This hooks straight into Google Fit and a bunch of different things like that. And also the fact that you can use it as a remote shutter if you have a Huawei phone. Wow. You download an application, and then once you've hooked it up, you can pose the shot obviously in selfie mode or whatever the case is, and then trigger the shutter from the band.
So that's a clever idea.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. Altogether, I think that there were some cool things that were launched at Mobile World, but it seems like the big focus this year was quite obviously on the Internet of Things on one hand, and the other thing being 5G.
Yes.
And the two being very, very closely interlinked, mainly because you're going to need a ton of bandwidth, which 5G provides, in order to run this ever-growing list of Internet of Things.
Yeah, so I mean, 5G is really for me is a big issue because I mean the operators in South Africa have struggled to get 4G off the ground because of ICASA's incompetence and inability to license spectrum. I'm hoping that when in the next few year or so when we might just have to skip 4G and just go straight to 5G because.
4G is here, but not in earnest.
But I mean, it might be better to use the spectrum we have available for a 5G network rather than a 4G network.
Sure.
But I think the only way we're really going to get 5G, because these things become more and more expensive to roll out for individual operators, is for all the operators to club together into a single pool, build a nationwide 5G network.
And then just share it.
And then share it.
It's not a bad idea.
I don't think the value is in having the network anymore.
The interesting thing...
If you've got a 4G network, if you've got a 3G network, I mean, I get fantastic speeds of a 3G network.
Yeah, but the point is, in 10 years' time, right, with easily 10 to 100 times more devices on that network, right, the experience is not going to be fantastic. And that's what they're saying about 5G. Largely the reason you need it is because right now in your home network, Ben, you've got, maybe 10 devices connected to the internet via your hotspot, right?
Yeah.
Via your router, if that many. I think if you count smartphones and gaming consoles and a couple of other things, you've probably got 10 to 15 devices across a average family of four people connected to the internet at any one point in time. Fast forward 5 years into the future when the Internet of Things is commonplace. And I mean, this is the reality. We're talking about it being 5 years away. It's literally that close. Right? Everything is going to be connected to the internet in some way, mean, or form. Your sprinkler system that irrigates your garden is going to be cloud connected. Why would you want a cloud connected sprinkler system? Is because you want it to be fed by a weather service that's going to inform it whether or not it needs to water based on what the weather conditions are, likelihood of rain. You don't want to be wasteful, et cetera, et cetera. You want your fridge to automatically tell your smartphone that you need to collect milk on the way home because it's out of milk. You want to be able to browse through a set of recipes on your microwave oven, which is informed by what the ingredients inside your fridge are, et cetera, et cetera. Yes. All of this kind of stuff is going to be interconnected.
You mean the stuff that we were promised 10 years ago and we might actually be going to get now.
And that's not to mention the huge number of wearables you're going to be looking at. I mean, while Google has put a hold on glass, that kind of thing is going to be revived at some stage. I mean, I look at it, I've got at least 2 fitness trackers on me at this point in time. Yes, because I'm a geek, and yes, because these things are supposed to be more accessible to me, but that, by virtue of that, tells me that in 5 years' time, other people will be in exactly the same boat. A smartphone and a fitness tracker, in all likelihood. That and all of these things start speaking to each other and speaking to the cloud. You're talking about going from 10 devices in your home to 100 devices in your home speaking to the cloud.
I'm just saying.
They're going to consume so much more bandwidth. And, I mean, that's the thing. It's not about data volume, so to speak. It's about bandwidth. It's about you increase the number of devices speaking to the internet tenfold. You increase the amount of bandwidth requirement tenfold, right?
But if you think about it, the reason why I'm saying is I'm hoping the operators get together and build the one network to rule them all, is because trying to get the kind of coverage you need for all those devices is going to need an order of magnitude more base stations than any one operator will want to build. The cells are going to be slightly smaller because of the nature of the beast. The more bandwidth you push through a single base station, the smaller the coverage area gets generally. And so because of that, they're going to have to have more base stations. Now, the fact is that environmental regulations, the whole not in my backyard attitude of certain key areas, all those things are going to work against operators putting up more base stations, finding more sites, especially in metropolitan areas. It's going to be extremely difficult. There are tons and tons of base stations out there already. All they need to do is say, we're willing to contribute our base stations into this pool of infrastructure so that we can run 5G off every single base station.
Now, here's my question in terms of that, all right? Networks are generally built to spec based on the amount of users connected to them, right?
Yeah.
Am I right in assuming that, right?
So, I mean, you hope that the expected usage.
So for me, and I mean, I hear where you're coming from, but I think at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that South Africa has got a finite user base for something like 5G. Okay, you're pretty much sure what that's going to be. The one approach is to have every single network operator speaking to a quarter of that, a market, or servicing a quarter of that market potentially, or a consortium of all network operators addressing 100% of that market. I agree with you, it would be cheaper to have the latter in place. But I think that, it would counteract the whole dynamic of competition that we really need in order to keep on driving service levels up and costs down.
Well, I think that, if they're all paying the same rates, then costs are going to come down. Because it's going to be cheaper to build the network and cheaper to leverage it. And a single wholesale operator would make that easier. We're already seeing towers being sold. We're seeing MTN and Telkom SA, Telkom sharing their networks. You're seeing talks of them, of Telkom selling their network, their mobile network, to MTN. You've got Vodacom and Cell C sharing elements of their network.
No, sure, and I can see in little pockets where that makes sense. In very underserviced areas, that kind of economy of scale.
If you've got 4 base stations covering Nelson Mandela Square in Zandton, okay, and there are thousands of people going through there, you can build in. Vodacom can build their 5G network, and MTN can build theirs, Cell C can build theirs, Telkom can build theirs, and they all put 5G onto their base stations, and it gets to a point and you get congestion. I mean, I know if you go to Ellis Park, the Cell C bandwidth at Ellis Park is so shocking that even if you've got 5 bars of network coverage,
you're getting nothing through.
Absolutely nothing through. When Ellis Park isn't even full. Not even talking test match. We're talking Curry Cup Lions game here. You're talking
absolutely
10,000 people in the stadium, and not even all of those are Cell C subscribers. Not all of them are trying to Instagram at the same time. But basically, the moment you walk into a stadium, you have no cell phone throughput. especially data-wise. So, and that's just going to get worse as we add more and more devices. Now, if you say, well, we've got four base stations and they're all 5G-enabled and everybody can hook onto whatever base station they need to hook onto to get the throughput, and the network can dynamically allocate those users to those four base stations, which are shared by the operators, then suddenly we have an opportunity there that we've quadrupled the amount of throughput on the thing. And it's not reliant on, are there more MTN subscribers in this neighborhood than Cell C subscribers? Everybody gets good coverage. All the customers are happy, or all the customers are unhappy.
How would they compete, though? This is my question. How would they compete?
Well, how do they compete now?
Well, they compete now.
They compete on price.
On walking the very, very thin tightrope between the cost of their service and the quality of their service.
And the service, and the actual service they provide, not just this telephone service, the actual, like when I phone MTN's call center, and do I get a good thing there or not?
No, sure. And I mean, generally, you're only phoning the call center if you have some kind of problem. But the point I'm trying to make is the more people spend on their network. No, indeed. But the more people spend on their network, all right, generally speaking, the better quality the service, and the higher price they're able to command, right? And it's about finding that. But I mean, if you don't have autonomous control over how you've built your network or the costs that contribute to it, I think it dramatically influences your ability to set a competitive
I just don't think that the network operators in South Africa will be able to effectively build a full 5G network and get the kind of coverage that they need. With the amount of capital that they have available to them.
Thankfully, we've got some time, I think.
Yes, probably a couple of years.
5 or 10 years.
I think so.
Well, they're talking about 5G 10 years away.
So, yeah.
Worldwide. So, anyway, interesting to see.
Yes.
The other thing that I found quite cool and out of left field at Mobile World this year was the number of alternative power solutions. I mean, a lot of guys launching fuel cells, which are quite interesting from the perspective that you either have these little snap-in modules that are preloaded with the chemical,
yeah.
You know, it's normally some form of like a salt or some form of potential difference between one element and another element. There's a variety of different ways to do it, but one crowd I spoke to had these. They're already rolled out in the UK now. And you can buy a module that clips into your existing charger device that is just the fuel, okay? And then what it does is that's good for like five iPhone chargers, and that sells for about £6. I think it's quite expensive. A pound for an iPhone charger is quite heavy. But that's, again, a solution designed for people that are going out camping or whatever the case is.
Yeah.
And then another one that actually has this little salt cartridge that you have to drop into the device and wet it. And then what happens is it's like, basically just salt and water, ionized water, that creates this fantastic chemical reaction and generates power. So that stuff's starting to become a reality, which I think is quite interesting. Still no completely free power. I mean, many nuclear reactors yet.
No fusion reactors.
Exactly.
But I think it's quite interesting because, I mean, I know I'm late on the bandwagon, but I finally went out and bought myself a little battery pack to charge up my phone. And just having one, that extra, like, ability when you're out on the road or you're away from things makes, like, a night and day difference. So, I mean, and not everybody's going to go out and buy a battery pack, but, I mean, if we can work out a way to, I mean, £6 is a bit ludicrous, but it's just...
And that's just for the charge, yeah. And then the thing is you've got to return that, right, in order to buy another one for £5 or £6.
So it's early days, though. And it's niche markets, but I think, I mean, if I could go into like the local engine shop and go, actually, I need a charge, and pay $10 or whatever it is, $10 for a charge. You know, if my phone's dead, $10 is worth it.
No, absolutely. And I mean, mm-hmm. I think what's going to catch on a lot quicker than this is these, devices that are fed by fuel cells are charged up using alternative power, and they are pretty much just like you were saying, these little battery packs. A lot of the time, that kind of makes sense is if you're returning one, the same as gas cylinders in winter, right? And people use gas cylinders ad nauseum to, plug into gas heaters and stuff like that. The same concept is the ticket to the ball game is to buy one of these devices that's fully charged, and you obviously pay a premium for a brand new charged one. And then every time you need a charge, you just drop it off at a gas station and pay your $10, like you were saying, and pick up another one that's been fully charged. That might work quite well. Yeah. You know, we shall see.
There's a lot of opportunity and a lot of options available, and I think it's going to be quite cool to see where it goes.
But again, it keeps on striking me as, you know, this is an interesting first world problem because... people are just happy to be able to get like light and stuff like that.
Well, I don't think it's a first world problem. I think if the cost comes down low enough, then people, instead of, they'll go to the local spaza shop and they'll say, whatever it is, I need a charge.
Your problem there is your distribution network. I mean, logistically, how do you get the fuel cell device to the spaza shop and stuff like that? I think that, I'm not for one second saying that power is a first world problem. Power is absolutely a third world problem. Hugely. But I think that your solutions there are going to be things that are more readily top-upable, such as solar, etc.
No, absolutely.
Ironically enough, those things have got a much higher acquisition cost to contend with, so that's not ideal. Anyway, let's move on to something that Ben and I have been wanting to speak about for the whole episode, because both of us are what you call in the industry Mac fanboys or Mac bigots. So let's talk about the Apple announcements. I was a little underwhelmed. I was like, meh, but you know what? A lot of people are raving about it. What did you think of the keynote and more specifically the products that were launched?
So, I mean, I think the watch, we knew it was coming. Okay, there were no surprises there. I mean, we knew exactly what we were going to get. All we got was proper
pricing availability,
which is fine. The most interesting
and a lie about battery life, but we'll get into that in a sec.
The most interesting thing was the new MacBook, which is, I'm not quite sure how to place it in the range.
Yes, I think people are very much in
two camps here. Basically, there's a lot of people saying Apple have got it completely wrong. But I don't think so. I think Apple have got it completely right, okay? Because what Apple do is they try to minimize the amount of ports that you can have available on your machine, firstly. They try to make things as small and thin as possible.
Yep.
And the fact is that there have been far too many times where we've been given, where Apple have launched something and people have gone, this will never work. You know, Apple have screwed the pooch this time. They just really haven't got any clue about what they're doing.
Absolutely. I can think of many products where that was said and not one that completely tanked in terms of sales to the point where they needed to pull it off the market.
The only real failure that Apple have had of recent, well, even recent years, was the Cube, which was too expensive and had manufacturing issues. But for me, the MacBook is...
That's pre-Jobs, eh?
Yeah. No, that was Jobs. That was
the Cube.
The Cube.
I don't remember the Cube.
It's a beautiful, beautiful machine, but just wasn't really ready for its time.
Okay.
But for me, the issue is Apple have not turned around and said to you, every single Apple product, MacBook Pro, Retina, normal Air that you buy is going to be configured this way. They have produced one product for a special niche market, okay? And they're going to see if it sells.
Yeah, well, look, it's going to sell.
It's going to sell, but the question is, essentially what they're now doing is they're putting a certain group of their consumers into a nice, very nice, organized beta test for
why you never buy Gen 1 Apple
how
anything.
How many ports do you need on a computer? Is it possible to get by only one USB-C port
and a headphone port? You're going to complain.
Okay.
But I can tell you that because this is also the charging port, don't forget.
Yes.
This is also how you get power into the device. And let me tell you something. The most frustrating thing, because I have a device that works exactly like this. I have a fantastic little Lenovo Windows 8 Slate that is probably one of my favorite devices. It's got killer battery life, it's elegant, it's quick, it's the same size as an iPad, but it's also at the same time a full-blown PC running Windows 8. And it has a USB 3 port in the top, which is used for charging the device. All right. But it being a full-blown PC, you also want to do things like connect devices to it over USB. Storage,
yes.
A DSTV drifter on occasion, an external optical drive from time to time. It is impossible to do that. Or check this out, all right, your smartphone, because if it happens to be a Sony smartphone and it gets a new firmware upgrade, it has to be done between the PC and and the phone with a cable, right? It's the only way you can get the firmware upgrade onto it. That you can't do while simultaneously powering the device because it's got one USB 3 port on it, right? And no one has yet designed something that allows for you to communicate data via a USB 3 charger type affair. So that's a really, really big problem. Unless they've purpose-built a peripheral which allows you to then again plug extra USB devices into the charger and have them work on the USB port, that'll be great.
So somebody showed this, says the most important thing Apple announced wasn't actually the MacBook, it was the
charger thingy.
There's a dongle, essentially, which gives you an HDMI port, standard USB 3 port,
okay,
and a USB-C port, so you can plug your
charger into the USB-C and then your
screen into the HDMI and your peripherals into the USB 3 port.
Which essentially they designed a very cool dock with one interface, which is USB-C.
But for me, it's a beta test. Okay, they want to see how people deal with this in the real world. They can test it as much as they like in the labs, but people, there's a certain group of people who want a product like this, who don't plug anything in. The only thing they do is they plug it into charge once a day, and then they walk away. They want a really nice, slick, fast, doesn't have to be fast, a reasonably fast machine, which they can take to presentations and lug between meetings, because that's all they do all day, But they want a great screen. They want it to be thin. They want it to be light, and they want it to be small. And that's what Apple are giving them. It's a very specific user case. But the thing which I always remember is that's exactly what we said about the iPad. And people found uses for it. People found use cases for it.
Well, this is the interesting thing, is it was touted for the longest time as a media consumption device. Do you know how many people I saw at Mobile World using their iPads for media creation? It's insane.
Yeah.
People are typing up full stories and uploading them to their CMSs using this. Yes. People are taking photos, editing videos, editing audio, doing all of this kind of stuff. It just took a while for it to mature. I don't see that as being a problem with this device, though. Here's the interesting thing. I think it's beautiful. I think that the design is stunning. It looks like a 12-inch MacBook Air, really. I love that polished little Apple logo on the back. I love the fact that it's available in gold, because I think it's not a screamy, very loud look at me.
It's not hip hop gold.
It's like almost like a little champagne color, which I think is really, really cool. I have concerns about the processor, though. That is where I think this experiment that you're talking of kind of lies firmly at, because the reality is, it's a killer little processor for what it is. Don't get me wrong. Core M has got a very specific role to play inside this market, all right? But it's not as quick as the old Core i5s or Core i7s, okay? It's far more power efficient than those. But right now, there are times where I butt my head up against the performance limitations of my Core i5 with 8 gigs of RAM Retina, okay?
I've got the target market.
Exactly, and I'm just going to have to realize this. It is a very expensive Chromebook, really, is what we're talking
about.
Exactly,
So, and it's a very specific market, but I think it is, the test is how many, Apple wants to know how many ports do you need. And I think you'll see the next generation MacBook Pros coming out with 4 USB-C ports or 2 USB-C ports.
Well, look, if you can fit more USB-C ports than traditional USB, what is it, Type-B?
Well, it means Apple will be able to kick to the curb, okay? Thunderbolt, USB 3, the charging port, okay? So instead of having 3 separate ports on your machine, you can have one port to rule them all.
Yeah, again, but I look at it and I kind of go, I don't know whether that solves a huge problem. Like, from the perspective that USB devices do things that USB devices do.
Yes.
Thunderbolt, I agree. There's kind of a little, bit of overlap between those two.
For me, it's a cost issue.
You don't think that the electronics that go into the inside of that thing from a board perspective and the chip that manages all of that stuff is going to be a more difficult, more complex, more costly thing to build into the board?
Than having 3 different systems. Now you're buying one set of chips from one manufacturer, and it's the same thing that everybody else is going to be buying now.
Okay.
Everybody else. Lenovo,
Acer. How much cost do you really think you can say,
if they save a dollar per machine and they sell a million machines, they're saving $1 million.
Yeah, but Apple doesn't think in millions, they think in multiples of a million.
Yes, but if every dollar you save, and if you're not having to engine when you're building that machine, if you're not having to spend the research and development time engineering how to build multiple systems onto your logic boards, you can just drop in the same, like multiples of the same chip, and you're getting the speed through which you need, and you're getting the compatibility that you need. Apple made USB when they launched the iMac, and I think that Apple are going to make USB-C because of this machine, because now everybody's going to switch to that. The question is whether Apple will switch to USB-C and dump Lightning as well.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see.
And I think if Apple is smart, that's exactly what they'll do.
You're saying move to USB-C on iPads and iPhones?
The size of the port is almost identical, and I think that it's completely reversible, and I think you can do very similar stuff. You can charge through it, you can play media out through it, you can do a lot of things through it that you can't do a normal USB or micro USB, and that might give the option for Apple to say, let's just switch to a standard, an industry standard, because we don't have to build our own thing anymore. And we can
save research and
development time there. You know, it's how much time do you have to spend in the labs, like testing stuff? And if you can cut a month off your testing time because you're using an industry standard product, then you're saving a lot of money there, and you can get stuff to market faster, and it's working, and then it's compatible with a whole lot of stuff.
Look, I think it's an interesting idea whether they're going to do it. I mean, they've always been a little bit otherwise. I mean, they couldn't even adopt USB. Micro USB, even though it's a EU standard now.
Yeah, so. But micro USB doesn't do certain things. You can't charge and play back, and Lightning's got a lot more functionality, well, certain more functionality than, and I, as I understand it, USB-C, and I stand to be corrected here, USB-C
does all of those things,
which, so you can charge and play music back, so you can use it as a connector for a media player or like a boombox of some sorts.
Okay.
It will give people the option of going that one step beyond. I mean, it'll make all their peripheral manufacturers happy because, you know, there'll be a lot of like peripheral industries which will be able to say, well, we only have to build one product, and it doesn't make a difference whether you're using an Android phone or an iPhone or a BlackBerry or a thing, because everybody's going to have switched to USB-C as their standard connector for their phones.
So you think the MacBook was the most important announcement to come out of that Apple launch?
Well, this is the most interesting.
What about Research Kit?
That was very sweet.
That, I think, is the most exciting bit. Only because, I mean, it solves a truly pressing problem in the market, and it's open source. I think that is really, really exciting. I've been saying for a while that the whole wearables market is way too obsessed with fat and fitness and all of this kind of stuff. It needs to start looking at how devices can be used to help sort out real medical problems, illnesses, chronic illness, all of this kind of stuff. And the best part is you don't specifically need a special kind of wearable for this. It'll work with iPhone. It'll work with a variety of other stuff. And because it's open source, it'll be adaptable to that. That, I think, is the most interesting thing. But also the fact that there's very explicit privacy detail built into it in terms of what you share, how you share it, and the fact that you will always be in control of your data, and that your data isn't actually stored in the cloud. That for me is quite exciting.
Yeah, I mean, I also like the fact that, you know, it gives researchers this great tool, open source firstly tool,
yes,
which is really nice to find interesting ways to do things. I mean, and yes, you can link in wearables to it as well.
So, you can, absolutely. I mean, I just like the fact that it's not prescriptive about one or another kind of wearable.
No, it's not. But I mean, if you're doing things around, like they showed like for Alzheimer's, where the handshake, yes, like you can test, you hold the phone up and you launch the app and it measures how much your hand is shaking, you know?
Totally.
Or if you say a certain sound into the microphone for Parkinson's, and the way you say it is a key indicator of early onset Parkinson's or things like that. That is also amazing, you know? So I think it's the other way around, actually. I think it's POTS is shaking and Alzheimer's is the...
Yeah, we get the idea, though. Yeah. No, you're dead right, though.
But it is, I mean, you're really getting that kind of, like, now granular, and you can roll it out to, like, millions of people, you know? And people and people can participate, and you can get a huge amount of real industry data across these kind of things from people who want to volunteer and make it easy, you know?
Sure. Okay, so, Ben, we need to wrap up because you're going to be on your way shortly, or you need to leave very, very shortly. So let's jump straight into picks of the week. Did you bring a pick with you this week?
I did. For once, I actually remembered to bring a pick.
Okay, very good.
So I've been playing this game. It's an iPhone game, iPhone iPad game called Alto's Adventure.
Alto's Adventure.
Alto, A-L-T-O.
Alto apostrophe S, yeah. Adventure.
And it's not a free game. You pay 25 Rand for it.
And it's for iOS, right?
For iOS, yep. And it's a bit of a snowboarding game. It's a 2D, you know, you start down the snow, the mountain, you're chasing llamas, collecting coins.
Chasing llamas, I love it.
Doing backflips on your thing, jumping over stuff, grinding on rails, things like that. It's really beautifully, the main attraction for it is that it is beautifully illustrated. It cycles through the day, you get lightning, you get thunderstorms. In it, so it's not the same background all the time. Sometimes sure. It's nighttime, sometimes it's daytime, it's dusk, it's sunrise. It looks beautiful and it's a lot of fun to play until you get to just below level 20, when you have to do 2 triple black flips in one run, and it's damn impossible to do.
You spend the next 2 weeks trying to get your 2 double blackflips.
And then they change the so you start off with one character. And then when you get to level 10, you get a new character.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
Level 20, I'm assuming you get a new character. I think there's 4 or 5 characters you can collect over all the levels. And you get the little, like, 3 achievements per level, which you have to do. There's no in-app purchases, although you do collect coins. So I'm hoping they add in the only thing I want to be able to buy with the in-game currency. You can buy some stuff with in-game currency. There's only 3 things you can buy. There's, like, 2 upgrades and then 1 extra thing you can buy. So, but once you've got that, then
you want cool snowboards. That's what
no,
you want.
No, that's not what I want. I want the ability to pass by an achievement. So,
you want to be able to Candy Crush something. You want to just go, I will give you money. I will give you these virtual coins I've earned through playing your game.
In order to not have to do 2 triple black flips and to get to level 20.
Yeah, you see, that'd be cool.
Because it is frustrating when you get stuck somewhere and you can't progress in the game. You know there's something else further on, but you can't progress. But yes, I mean,
that's why everyone says the whole money and the in-app purchase thing is completely wrong when it comes to gaming. But you know what? A lot of the time you kind of go, well, I don't have time to spend the next 2 weeks trying to do these 2 double backflips. Yeah. So no.
But yeah, so I mean, I'm glad that it's not proper in-app purchases, but I would be able to this is version 1, okay? Well, 1.0.1 is the version at the moment, okay? So they obviously it's going to have a long way to go, but I think that these guys have done a really nice job. It's a really beautiful game. It doesn't cost a fortune. $25 is not going to bankrupt anybody. It's like one coffee, you know.
Absolutely. Ben buys expensive coffee.
Yeah. it's really is worth it. I mean, it got good reviews all across the web. Wired gave it a really nice review, which is where I saw it the first time. And, you know, sometimes you need just a game you can play for like 5 minutes and then walk away. And that's the kind of game, you know, just to pass the time while you're waiting for the airplane or sitting for a meeting or whatever, you know, or sitting in the queue at Home Affairs.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I mean, you know, I love gaming from that perspective. I think it's really, really fun.
Yeah.
So cool. That is called Alto's Adventure. I'll put the link in the show notes. Thanks, Ben. My pick of the week is something I happened upon a while back, but I've only really started playing with in the past week or so. And that is something called the Suffer Fest. Do you know what the Suffer Fest is, Ben?
The name is familiar, but...
Okay, so the Sufferfest essentially is... if you're a cyclist, you'll know about the Sufferfest because it comes up in your Facebook profile the whole time promoting itself. But essentially, it is a bunch of training videos that you can use as a cyclist to make your interval training more exciting. Okay, so traditionally, what you do with... you know, their whole business model is, cycling training is not fun, and cycling itself can be quite demanding. There's a lot of suffering that takes place in climbs and stuff like that. And the whole idea is apparently to endear yourself to the pain you feel while cycling, because if you learn to like it, you'll become a better cyclist. These are essentially videos that build on different skills and encourage you to work out harder and get fitter through doing these kinds of simulations. So a lot of the footage inside these videos comes straight out of the Tour de France, Giro d'Italia, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're a fan of those things and a cyclist, you'll absolutely love it. The premise is really, really simple. You start out inside a scenario. It's a live video that's playing at you. It's got cool music playing in the background. It's got a commentator. A lot of the time, it changes the scenarios up on you. It's like, okay, it's time to attack. Get out of your seat. Your cadence needs to be X, Y, Z, blah, 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 blah. Why am I talking about all of this in the context of tech? Well, I came across the Sufferfest a while back, and I only came across the app in the past week, and the app is unbelievably cool and polished for a variety of mobile devices. Ideally, you'd hook it up to your tablet and use it on a stationary trainer. It's not really designed to be out on the road, because the point is when you're out on the road, you've got real stuff happening in the real world. But you can either buy the videos explicitly, like on a video by video basis, or they've got specials that run all the time where you can buy, like for example, right now for $200, $199, you can buy the entire collection of all of their videos, and then you've got access to them. There's also a subscription. So you can pay like $10 a month and subscribe to the service, and then make use of their training plans, which are also very, very cool. But what I liked in the time since I first came across it and this past week that I've been playing around with it is it has videos for cyclists, runners, and triathletes,
yeah,
which I think
nice.
Is really, really nice. And, of course, from a triathlon perspective, the swimming element is not going to be there because, let's face it, you're not going to take your iPad into the pool with you. But the running and cycling BRICS training, and also the kind of training you will be doing as a triathlete in preparation for your event is really, really cool. So, and quite different from everything else. So the fact that they've adapted it to that, I really, really like. You can check it out at thesufferfest.com. Or just check it out on Facebook. Look for it in the Apple App Store. It's available on Google Play. And interestingly enough, they also have support for Roku, which was quite interesting. Or you can stream it through your normal web browser and stuff like that too. But I think you really want to use the application to get the full experience.
$13 per video.
$13 per video. Some of them are more expensive, some of them are cheaper. But again, I think the most cost-effective way to do it is either to just spring for the full $200 and get every single one of their videos, yeah, or take out a subscription for $9.99 a month and just enjoy the content.
I like the one where it says a 20-minute climb followed by the worst 5 minutes known to mankind.
Absolutely. And I mean, it being real footage from all of these races, it's super exciting. It's really fun from that perspective. Tons of support for road cycling, cyclocross, triathlon. They even have a nutrition guide, which is quite exciting. That's the sufferfest.com. There we go. Mr. Kelly, thanks for checking halfway across the world. Does that camel eat a lot of feed, or cheaper than running
efficient
on petrol?
Yeah,
okay, very good, very good. Mm-hmm. You put 95 unleaded
in the camel,
in the camel's humps, and then it just goes for days, right?
Pretty much.
You'll have to show me around it. I think we need to do a Wi-Fi upgrade on it sometime or something like that. Or maybe see if we can get that camel converted into a hybrid. That'd be exciting. Anyway, enough nonsense. Thanks for joining us on the ZA Tech Show. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, come back. Send us mail. Tell us what you think. You can find us on Twitter at ZA Tech Show. You can also find us at zats.htxt.co.za. You can Google for ZA Tech Show. You'll also find us there. We're available on iTunes. Just search for ZA Tech Show, and you can subscribe right there. At the same time, you can go to the HTXT website, and there's an RSS feed from there that you can click on and subscribe to it in your podcatcher of choice. But we hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you next week. Cheers.